Today, we're very happy to have our own David Kibisniak talking on a topic that's been lighting up the archive a lot recently on Gauss-Binet gravity and four dimensions. So, during the talk, if you have questions, David said he doesn't mind if you just turn on your microphone and interrupt. And then at the end of the talk, I'll moderate for any further questions. You can just hit the raise hand button to ask them. So, thank you very much, David. Take it away.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks everybody for joining this seminar. So let's just jump into that. So this is the Lovelock theorem, which goes all the way till 1971. And basically what it says is that in four dimensions, the Einstein-Hilbert action is the only action that leads to the second-order differential equations for the metric. So in other words, Einstein's theory in four dimensions is the unique theory of gravity. There is nothing else than that. Yet, this paper, which appeared a month ago, which says there is another gravity in four dimensions, and it's called Gauss-Bonnet gravity in four dimensions, and it also has second-order differential equations. So, today's seminar is about what's going on and how to make sense of these claims. So here's the plan of the talk. So I will first, logically, I hope, explain what Gauss-Bonnet gravity is and what Lovelock gravities more generally are. Then I will review the proposal by Klammann and Lin, and also state what the problems are with this proposal and what more generally are the problems with this naive D2-4 limit. And then I will tell you, yes, actually, we can make sense of this 4D gravity. And there's two ways how to do that. One is through Kaluza-Klein approach, and the other one is through conformer trick. And then I will also tell you that actually this does not work only in four dimensions, but you can do the same tricks in lower dimensions, and then you can have Gauss-Bonnet gravity in three dimensions or Gauss-Bonnet gravity in two dimensions. All right, so my talk is based on these two papers, which we put on the archive about 2 weeks ago. And so the first one is 2 weeks ago, second one is 1 week ago. Unfortunately, we got scooped in the paper one by one day. And so there's this some overlap of paper one with this other publication, which is stated here. All right. Are there any questions so far? Then what is Gauss-Bonnet gravity? So let me start just very slowly with Einstein theory and just whatever I say when I teach the basic relativity course. So of course, if you want to write down the gravitational action, so we want to preserve the diffeomorphism invariance. So we want a scalar Lagrangian. And what we want is second order differential equations for the metric. So we want second order Euler Lagrange equations. So naively, what you would expect is that you are seeking a scalar which depends on the metric and its first derivatives. However, you also learn in the first course in relativity that there is no such scalar. So due to equivalence principle, you can always set the first derivatives of the metric to zero at a point, and so there is no, except the metric itself, there is no such scalar. So one can do is actually to write the Einstein production. And the simplest scalar which we are using here is the Ricci scalar, but that guy actually depends on second derivatives of the metric too. And so if you naively write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for this, you would expect that the resulting equations are actually fourth-order equations of motion. So in order to derive these Euler-Lagrange equations, you have to integrate by parts for each of the derivatives. So for two derivatives of the metric, I need to integrate twice, and in general, I will have fourth-order terms. So then how come the Einstein equations are actually second order and not fourth order? And so here is again what I teach in the basic course. What you do is that you take this Ricci scalar, you write it in a clever way, you write it in terms of the Ricci tensor times the metric, and then you have three terms which you need to vary. And so of course, the first two terms where you vary just the metric or the determinant of the metric, easy to calculate, so you calculate them. And then you tell the student, well, the last term is super difficult to calculate, and so you just throw it away, right? And so in this way, you actually recover the right Einstein equations, which, surprise, surprise, are not fourth-order equations, but are second-order equations of motion. And the trick why actually we could do this is that indeed the last term is actually a total derivative. So it does not contribute to the equations of motion. In other words, what it means is that actually, although we start with a Lagrangian, which has, in principle, two derivatives of the metric in it, it actually splits into two parts. The first part, which gives the second order equations of motion, and the second part, which does not contribute to these, and which contains, in general, the second derivatives of the metric. All right, so that's what you do in Einstein theory. Of course, you may think, well, Einstein theory is just the simplest possible choice. So I'm just choosing the Lagrangian, which depends on R. But there are many other possibilities. So you can choose R squared, R mu nu squared. And you can think, you can also put some derivatives of the curvature tensor and stuff like that. However, there is this Lovelock's beautiful Lovelock's theorem, which says in 4D, actually, you cannot put these terms. So it says, more precisely, the Einstein-Hilbert action is the only local action apart from cosmological constant and topological terms, which in our term would be just total derivatives, that leads to the second order PDEs for the metric. Was there a question? No?
I had a question to the previous slide, actually. You said the part that would lead to fourth derivatives can be thrown away because it's a total derivative. Can you then write a different action that has no second derivatives of the metric?
Yes, you can.
The part doesn't lead to equations of motion. We can just leave it out.
So yes, you can. You can actually extract this term, what it is. Unfortunately, and it's done in, for example, Landau and Lifshitz. So Landau and Lifshitz indeed decomposes this Lagrangian into the first part and the second part explicitly. But what you can show is that actually this is not covariant. So basically the first term is something like gamma-gamma, and it's definitely not covariant. So this decomposition is actually not covariant. This is not a tensor, and that is not a tensor. So if you want a tensor, which scale is the thing you have to write down? But this miracle happens that you actually can, you know, get rid of the second derivatives by total derivative. It's very explicitly written down in Landau and Lifshitz, and it's beautiful, actually. Well, it's not beautiful, it's quite ugly. The expression is super ugly, but you can do it.
Question?
Right, so, you know, one example, sorry, was there another question?
Yes, question. Are you ignoring the possibility that you have a first-order variational principle where the connection itself is also varied independently?
Well, sure, you can do that, of course, yes. Here I'm just talking about the standard approach, yeah. Yeah, you can do the first-order formalism.
Okay, and when you get to your conclusions, will that differ? Well, maybe we can discuss it then.
I would have to brush my memory about that. But my understanding is that if you vary the metric, you just get an algebraic equation. So you get something like, you get g mu equals to zero, but that's an algebraic equation for r mu nu or something like that. Anyway, so this is just the standard thing. In 4D, the Einstein-Hilbert action, the R, is the only one which you can write down, except topological terms. So one such topological term, which actually is a total derivative in four dimensions, is written here, and that's the Gauss-Bonnet term. And you can show that in four dimensions, this is precisely a covariant derivative. It's a total derivative. All right, so now what is Gauss-Bonnet gravity? That you take this term, but now you say, actually, I don't consider this in four dimensions, I go to higher dimensions. So what happens if you go to lower dimensions is that the term identically vanishes. In four dimensions, it is a total derivative. And in five dimensions and higher, it contributes to the equations of motion. And if you do vary with respect to this term, which I give to our Psi students, then you get this beautiful equation of motion. And if you look at this beautiful equation of motion, it only contains the curvature tensors. So there's nowhere here is a derivative of the curvature tensor. So what it means is that equations of motion are second-order equations of motion. So what it means also is that there must be a way how to write down this Gauss-Bonnet term precisely in the way what we did for the Ricci scale. There must be something which depends on the first derivative of the metric only plus a total derivative term. Okay, so Gauss-Bonnet gravity is basically this complicated Lagrangian which leads to the second order PDEs, but the term is only active in five dimensions and higher. More generally, lower gravity is a unique higher curvature gravity which yields second order PDEs. It can be written in this complicated way. So you have a sum over some coupling constants, alpha k, and then you have Euler densities here. And Euler densities are basically anti-symmetrized contractions of some Riemann tensors. There's a question.
Yes. What about taking your topological invariant and multiplying it by some other fields and then integrating it?
And yes. That's a very good question. So in the simplest case, thank you for the question. So in the simplest case, what people consider indeed is that they introduce, for example, a scalar field, and then they multiply, they take phi times g. And of course, now this is not a total derivative, and it has non-trivial contributions to the equations of motion, even in four dimensions. So then this leads to Einstein, Dilaton, Gauss-Bonnet gravity, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay,
so
great,
thanks. Back to Lovelock. So you have these, you know, complicated terms. And so, of course, if you take k equal to zero, then basically there's no of these guys. So it's just a cosmological term. So alpha zero coupling constant is just a cosmological constant, lambda. Then if you take k equal to one, you get the next term, which is just the Ricci scalar, which is the Einstein-Hilbert action. Then if you take k equal to two here, then you recover this Gauss-Bonnet term, which we just saw. And then if you go to k equal to three, then you get third order Lovelock and then fourth order Lovelock and so on. And so what is beautiful about these things is that these terms are all total derivatives in, you know, the dimensions which increase. So Ricci scalar is total derivative in two dimensions, Gauss-Bonnet in four dimensions, third order Lovelock in six dimensions and so on. So what it tells you is that basically the higher order terms in Lovelock are only active if you actually go to higher dimensions. And so in four dimensions, this guy does not contribute, and all you have is lambda and r. In six dimensions, well, in five dimensions, you have also this guy here, but it only appears in five and higher dimensions. And, you know, some people consider Lovelock gravity to be the most natural generalization of Einstein theory in higher dimensions. Okay, so now people actually go even beyond Lovelock. I just wanted to flash this in case you have these names. So basically what I say is that desperate times require desperate measures. And so people actually go beyond Lovelock and abandon these theories and consider more general theories, which have some nice properties. And so, for example, one very popular theory is a quasi-topological gravity, which was studied some years ago by Rob Myers. And basically that's a gravity which does not have second order equations of motion, but for spherically symmetric solutions, it does. So basically, you know, general fourth order equations of motion, they just reduce to second order if you consider spherically symmetric constants. And so interestingly enough, people are interested in these gravities. And then more recently, there was Einsteinian qubit gravity, or I put this shortcut for our paper, but I don't know what it actually means. It's single metric function vacuum spherically symmetric space-time gravity. So basically what we are saying here is that we constructed the most general theory which admits Schwarzschild-like solution, which is characterized. So if you consider vacuum solution, which is spherically symmetric, you in general have two metric functions, let's say f and h. So it's minus fdt plus dr square over g, or h or whatever. So now I'm saying these two functions are the same.
I have a question.
Yes.
What if you perturb this what do you perturb this spherical symmetric space-time? Is the equation motion still second order?
I don't know.
Linear perturbation on top of that.
Yeah. I think the linear perturbations are nice around flat space. So there you get basically what you get in Einstein gravity, I think. But I don't remember. I think if you go, you know, beyond spherical symmetry, you immediately encounter problems, I would think. But I'm not sure about the linearized level. So I don't know. I don't remember. Sorry.
Has anyone studied this already? Has anyone studied this linear perturbation of this quasi topological gravity?
Well, let me see.
David,
yeah.
The linearized level you can perturb about a constant curvature background in your graviton spectrum. There have not been any studies, to my knowledge, of perturbations beyond that, except for a recent thing in a cosmological setting by Starobinsky and collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's what I thought. So we did perturb around flat space or constant curvature space-time. But we, yeah, okay. Thanks,
David, Rob.
Yes.
But surely if you impose spherical symmetry, in some sense, you're reducing the numbers of dimensions, right? You're adding in degrees of freedom from sort of moduli, but you're essentially reducing your numbers of degrees of freedom. So you're kind of making it lower dimensional. So that, you know.
Thank you, Rose. This is an amazing question because this is precisely what I'll be doing in the second part.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the question. It's perfect. So everybody remembers that question, please. All right. So this is what level lock is. And so what is really important for the is that is topological in 2D, Gauss-Bonnet is topological in 4D, and so it starts contributing only in 5 and higher dimensions. Okay, so now we go to the 4-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity, and also by Glavin and Lin, and you see that the paper was published in PRL a couple of months ago, and of course, as every PRL, or almost every PRL, it's mostly wrong. So now I just highlighted some things which are actually not correct. So it starts, in this letter, we present a general covariant modified theory of gravity in four space-time dimensions. So it's certainly not true that there's a covariant modified theory, at least not in the proposal of the letter. It says, which only propagates massless graviton, which as we shall see is also not true. So there's actually extra fields in this theory. And then it, you know, goes how this is constructed. Basically, what they do is that they start with the Gauss-Bonnet term in higher dimensions, and then they do d goes to 4 limit of the resulting equations of motion. And then they say, in this singular limit, the Gauss-Bonnet gravity gives non-trivial contributions to the gravitational dynamics. That's certainly true. So they recover some new gravity, they recover some new solutions, but then they say preserving the number of graviton degrees of freedom, which is certainly not true, okay? So there's many statements in this letter which are not true, but certainly it's a very, very interesting paper, and it caused lots of fuss in the recent months, and I think in like 2 months it already got like 70 citations or something like that. What do they do, actually? So they actually start with an observation, is that if they write down the Lovelock equations of motion, which are written here, so I used P here instead of K. So if you use the sum over Euler Lagrange densities, Lagrangian, and you derive the equations of motion, this is what you get. And so now, you know, P equal to 0 is the lambda term, P equal to 1 is the Einstein-Hilbert term, P equal to 2 is the Gauss-Bonnet term. So then you see that you have D minus 4 here, okay? And which tells you, well, actually, if I'm in 4 dimensions, you know, this thing will be trivial and actually doesn't work. So then what they say is, well, because there is D minus 4 here, and then I will have alpha 2 here, why don't I actually say alpha 2 times D minus 4, why don't I call it nu alpha? If I do that, maybe this term actually does not vanish and it contributes to the gravitational action. So this is what they do. So they basically propose some kind of dimensional regularization. They go alpha times d minus 4 and they call it nu alpha. And then they take the limit d goes to 4. Okay, so that's the proposal. That's the observation which they made. So basically what they do is that they start with the theory which is Einstein-Hilbert-Gauss-Bonnet action in d dimensions, and then they rescale the coupling alpha, and then they take the limit of this to d equal to 4. But of course, they don't do this in general. They just do it for several solutions which have an enhanced symmetry. And so it's precisely what Roos was saying just a minute ago. Basically, these enhanced symmetry solutions are effectively lower dimensional already. And so there is no actual problems in doing these. But if you go beyond this very, very enhanced symmetry case, then you encounter immediately problems. So anyway, so what they do is that they consider maximally symmetric spaces, they consider the cosmological thing, and they consider the black holes, spherically symmetric black holes in this theory. So here's just some couple of results. So they discovered that now you have actually two branches of maximally symmetric solutions. One branch approaches, one branch has a nice limit when the coupling alpha goes to zero, the other one does not. Then they pair up around this maximally symmetric space, and then they comment, well, we actually cannot distinguish this from GR at this level. And then they construct, you know, cosmology, and then they realize that there is a modification to the standard Friedmann equation by this alpha term here, and also by this gamma standing here. So anyway, so I'm mostly interested in my talk in black hole solutions. So this is what you do. So basically, this is a solution of Gauss-Bonnet gravity in D number of dimensions. So you have just spherically symmetric thing. The remarkable thing is that you have the same function here, the same function there. And so this is in D dimensions. This is the general solution of Gauss-Bonnet gravity. And you see the factors D popping out everywhere. And then they notice, well, let's take the limit D goes to 4. And so if you look at where the factors D minus 4 appears, for example, here. Okay, so obviously I cannot take the limit D minus 4 unless I say that D minus 4 alpha is a new alpha. If I say D minus 4 alpha is a new alpha, then I can easily take the limit D goes to 4. And then the same thing happens here. So if I have D minus 4 alpha, I call it a new alpha, this is fine. And the same thing happens here. Okay, so you see that by rescaling the coupling constant, I can actually make sense of this solution in D equal to 4 dimensions. And so D goes to 4 limit of this metric is sort of straightforward, and that's what they did. And so here's what they obtained. So they get that, you know, there's one, so that you see there's two branches, plus minus. So one branch has nice smooth limit, alpha goes to 0, the other one does not. One branch looks like Schwarzschild, asymptotically. The other one does not. It looks like Schwarzschild De Sitter, I think. And what they calculate is now whether there are some singularities, and then they calculate, for example, the Ricci scalar. So now the Ricci scalar goes like 1 over R, so it blows up at in the origin. But when they say, well, actually, yeah, there's a singularity in the origin, but in fact, there is a repulsive potential for particles. And they say, well, if I send a particle, actually, it encounters this repulsive potential, and so it will never reach the singularity at r equal to 0. And so then they say, this is actually singularity, almost singularity free metric. There was two questions.
Hi, David. Do they assume alpha, the new alpha is constant?
Yes.
Okay, so then do they take the limit of D going to 5 to recover the what we expect, or if it's constant, is it only constant around 4, or is it constant?
No. So the resulting alpha, so of course, what you have to do is, right, so you have to call D minus 4 times alpha, you call it new alpha, right? So now if you are taking the limit D minus 4 goes to 0, then alpha is the original alpha has to go to infinity to get at a finite limit. Yeah, but in the end, after the limit, you say alpha is a constant.
Yeah, but that's
in the process of taking the limit, it is not, right?
It wouldn't work for 5, right? If you fix it for 4, then it wouldn't recover Gauss-Bonnet gravity in 5 dimension, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was another question.
I think in 5 dimension it does recover because when you rescale alpha to alpha over d minus 4 and then take d equals to 5, then it's actually what you have is alpha over 5 minus 4. You actually do not rescale alpha at all. So the results recover the standard result in 5 dimension.
So maybe I misunderstood. Of course, you can plug here D anything you want apart from D equal to 4, right? So if you plug D equal to 4, you encounter problems. And so that's what you want to avoid. And of course, that's what I was saying. That, you know, topological Gauss-Bonnet gravity is nice only in finite dimensions and higher, but you know, it's very difficult to take the limit D equals to 4. So anyway, so what they did is basically they these equations of motion, they took the limit equals to 4, and they recover some solutions, some metrics, but and then they claim these are the solutions of the new theory, But, you know, what is this new theory? It's not clear. You cannot actually write down the Lagrangian for this theory. You cannot write down the general covariant equations of motion. You just have some specific examples of solutions of some metric. Now, what are the problems with this? Of course, many people don't like this. And so let me just quote this paper here. And so it starts, is there a novel Einstein Gauss-Bonnet theory in four dimensions? Question mark, right? And so you probably already noticed that when there's a question mark in the title, the authors eventually reach a conclusion that the answer is no. So actually this time, the authors don't wait for eventually, and they immediately stay in the abstract, no. Okay, there's another paper which is here. Basically, the moral of the story is that, you know, the theory, even though you are taking the D goes to four limit, always remain high dimensional. And it's natural. So you start this, you know, in high dimensions, you have more equations of motion. And some of these equations have nice limit to four dimensions, and some of these don't. And so there's always extra equations of motion to be satisfied in general case, which actually cannot be taken to four dimensions, which don't vanish in the limit D goes to four dimensions. This is not the case for enhanced symmetry solutions, but in general, it is the case. Okay. Then we show this explicitly for top-knot spacetimes, is that actually if you start with top-knot solutions of Gauss-Bonnet theory in high dimensions, actually, there is no unique limit to four dimensions, and you can actually, you know, recover many candidates. And so perhaps this is not surprising at all. If you have more dimensions, you have more equations of motion to satisfy, you have more restrictions, if you want. Okay. Another very interesting paper, which actually says, well, basically puts the last nail in the coffin of this proposal, is by Kurt, and they basically show that no matter what you do, there is no other than GR, three-level graviton scattering amplitudes in four dimensions. And what they also show is that if you take actually the limit of high-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet scattering amplitudes, then one obtains amplitudes that correspond to certain scalar tensor theory. So it's not just a tensor theory, but you suddenly pop out a scalar as well. Okay, so basically the original proposal, as stated, doesn't make any sense, and it's not a well-defined theory. So the question is there a Gauss-Bonnet gravity in four dimensions? Questions? Any questions?
There's another paper by Mahapatra in which he looks at the total action in the D to four limit and finds that there are divergences on shell part of the action and the boundary part, which have no physical interpretation.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I agree. So I just, you know, chose these two things, but there's more criticism.
So the action is...
Right, so is there for the... Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, maybe later. So there are four-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity. And the answer is actually yes, but it's not definitely the Gauss-Bonnet gravity as predicted by Glavan and Lim. So it's actually one approach, which is the Kaluza-Klein approach. And this is something that has been studied for some time. I've noticed papers which go back to 2005, but maybe there is even older ones. But anyway, so there's this recent paper by Liu and Tang. And they basically show that if you consider the limit properly or in this Kaluza-Klein approach, then what you recover is actually a scalar tensor theory. And then, you know, a few days later, it was also done by Kobayashi. So what you do in this approach is that you start with the Einstein-Hilbert Gauss-Bonnet action in D dimensions, and then you compactify this action. So you make the following answers for the metric. So you have the p-dimensional metric, then you have the Brising scalar here, and then you have constant curvature space. So you decompose the D number of dimensions into P dimensions, which you are interested in the end, and then D minus P dimensional space, which is not interesting, and it's, you know, constant curvature space. Okay, so then what you do is that you plug the Sansatz into this action and you recover a simple result. Well, not really, but it's not that bad. Well, this is the effective p-dimensional action that you get. And so you see there's some prefactor of phi, and there's some, you know, the Einstein-Hilbert term, there's a kinetic term for the scalar field, and then there's alpha corrections to this. Okay, so this is what they got. And so what you are interested in is, again, taking the limit d goes to p, in which case p is four dimensions. So you want, you know, to see how the theory looks like on this four-dimensional, p-dimensional final space. So now if you look at this here, so it just tells you if I go with limit d goes to p, this term vanishes, so there's no this part here. You just get Einstein-Hilbert term. This guy sort of behaves like e to the zero, so that's fine. So now what you are really interested is in this correction alpha part. And so you see you have d minus p here, and then you have d minus p here, and you have d minus p here. So if I define alpha times d minus p and call it alpha, then this term survives, this term survives, this term survives. What about the alpha times Galois term? Well, that's the one. If I call it, you know, alpha divided by d minus p, well, alpha times d minus p, if I call it alpha, the first term actually diverges. So what you can do, what you have to do is that you have to subtract this divergence. But if you are eventually in four dimensions, this is what I'm doing here, I will be subtracting this term here. But in four dimensions, eventually, this is just a topological term. It's just a total derivative. So actually, I can do this. So if I call this term here by subtracting the corresponding, which is topological in four dimensions, eventually, then I get a finite action. Okay, so that's precisely what they did. They rescale the coupling, as I just said. They take the limit equal to p, and they recover a nice finite action, which looks like, you know, Einstein-Hilbert path, and then you have precisely this, you know, Einstein-Dilaton-Galois-Bonnet term, which Lee asked about, and then you have some corrections here. So this looks like, but notice here that you have some, you know, crazy kinetic terms for the scalar field, but actually these are so crazy in a way that the resulting thing actually gives you second order equations of motion. So the first term is for, you know, this, also what I remind you what lambda is. So lambda is just the curvature of this space here, of the maximally symmetric space here. So if I set lambda equal to zero, I just get a flat space. The extra space is flat space. So this is what you get for the flat space, for the flat internal space, and this is the correction which you get if you have non-trivial lambda here. So I think this is the theory which we should call Gauss-Bonnet theory in four dimensions, and it depends on you whether you want this lambda to have or you don't. Okay, but this is what comes out from the Kauser-Klein prescription. So notice one more thing, which is quite interesting thing, and which I think actually makes it novel. So people have been doing this compactification, as I say, many, many years. But what they haven't done is to take the limit d goes to p. Why? Well, if you look at the limit of d goes to p, then your internal space that you compactify on actually becomes zero-dimensional. And I think that's the new, quite interesting thing. So you basically compactify on something which has zero-dimensional internal space. So you basically are doing the limit where you start in four dimensions, and you compactify on zero dimensions, and you end up with four dimensions. Okay, so this is the theory. Well, then, the theory, if you look at it, it is actually Hondesky-type theory, and it gives second-order equations of motion. What is quite interesting is that the same theory can be derived in a different fashion by a conformal trick, which was used many, many years ago by Mann and Ross to derive d equal to 2 limit of general relativity. And if you want, that trick actually is quite nice because it doesn't require any assumption of extra dimensions. So let me just repeat that argument. So everybody have this Kauser-Klein argument? Maybe. Okay. So now let me tell you what the conformal trick is. And it's,
David, if I can ask. So once you obtain the theory and the limit, the origin of, you know, the setup and the trick that you use to obtain the theory becomes sort of irrelevant. You've got a theory, and that's, you know, in a sense, that's all that matters.
you so much for that. Yeah, of course. That's thank you so much, Eric. Yeah, I agree. So basically, yeah, okay. Thanks.
Not a deep point.
Well, it is. All right. So another way how to obtain the same theory is through this conformal trick. So, and it's the same as was done for d equal to 2 limit of GR. So how that works? So you start with the Einstein-Hilbert action in d dimensions. And of course, this is topological in 2 dimensions, so this doesn't give you any nice theory in 2 dimensions. So then what you do is that basically you just evaluate this Einstein-Hilbert action for a conformally scaled metric. So you consider G tilde, which is E to phi, phi some scalar field, times G. Then you expand around 2 dimensions and, you know, subtract some divergence, which actually is, again, topological in 2 dimensions. And, you know, if you want, the subtraction is something like adding a counter term to the action and take the limit D goes to 2. So what you're really doing is that you consider, you know, the Einstein-Hilbert action expressed for this conformally rescaled metric. You subtract the Einstein-Hilbert action again. This is what you get if you expand around epsilon 2 dimensions. Then you rescale the coupling. So you have the original coupling times 0 is a new coupling, and take the limit epsilon goes to 0. What you get is a beautiful theory, which is, again, scalar tensor theory, which now has some kinetic term for the scalar. And all it does is that you just take the Ricci scalar times psi, which is precisely what Lee was suggesting. So now, although R is topological in 2 dimensions, if you multiply by psi, it is no longer topological. It's a beautiful trick how to get this theory. Okay, and so what is really interesting, this theory was studied, you know, in 2 dimensions quite a lot. And what is actually interesting is that if you take, again, a naive limit of the solutions which you know in Einstein theory in D dimensions, and you take D equals to 2, then this is typically the solution of this theory here. So in particular, you can get a black hole solution, which is in some sense is a limit, D goes to 2 limit of the Kerr solution. And you know, if you want to read more, there's a recent paper by Rob here. Okay, so this is the limit, this is the way how the conformal trick works to recover this beautiful theory in 2 dimensions. Now you can do the same thing in 4 dimensions, but now for Gauss-Bonnet. So basically what you do is, again, you take the Gauss-Bonnet for the conformal rescale metric, you subtract the original Gauss-Bonnet, you expand around d minus 4, you rescale the coupling, and you take the limit d goes to 4. And up to some trivial, you know, field redefinition, it precisely gives you exactly the same theory which you got by the Gauss-Klein complexification. So there is something about this theory, and as I say, I think this is the theory to consider and to call four-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity.
I have a question. I know this conformal trick works in 2D. That is because in 2D, Riemann tensor has only one independent component, right? So what you need, you just need to require this counter term you add in, do not generate a new term in the equation motion. But since Riemann tensor only has one component, independent component, so at the end, you just one scalar field, this conformal scalar field, is able to compensate the contribution from this counter term. But in a 4D case, you have, 22 or something, this is an independent component from Riemann tensor. And then I don't know how can that one conformal scalar can compensate the contribution from all of components of Einstein equation from this counter term.
No, but you end up with the Einstein equations plus a scalar, right? And so if you want, that scalar sort of comes from this topological term, and, you know, Gauss-Bonnet term is topologically equally in 4 dimensions as is the Ricci scalar in 2 dimensions. So actually, I'm not that surprised. I don't know.
No. So you have this the first term GG tilde, right? And then the second term GG. Which one? It doesn't matter. One of them is counter term to deduce from the original.
Yeah, this
one,
is the right? counter term. Yeah.
Yeah, and then. For this resultant theory to be equivalent to the original one, the necessary condition is this contribution to the equation motion from this counter term must be trivial.
Yeah, and they are. Once you take the limit, d goes to 4, because this counter term is then just topological and doesn't give any equations of motion.
But you have, when you rescale the alpha, it's not exactly.
Yeah, well, it's a subtle limit, right? So it is a subtle limit. So what you are basically getting, if you are taking the limit d goes to 4, you have the Gauss-Bonnet coupling, which is a total derivative, but of course it's divided by epsilon. So what you are really throwing away when you are adding this counter term is sort of like topological term or total derivative divided by times infinity, right? So that's what you are really doing, but that's fine, I think. So you know, as long as the resulting thing is topological, then this should be fine.
Oh, wait a moment. This alpha is original alpha, or this alpha is alpha over d minus 4?
So this is the original alpha which you start with, but then I say, you know, this alpha is a new alpha divided by d minus 4. Okay, and then obviously this term is sort of like diverging term, but it also is a total derivative.
I'm not sure. But let's discuss later. Okay, you can go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a question. The equation of motion for the scalar field is of high order in derivatives.
No, it's not. It's an interesting question. It looks like it must be, right? It looks like you have a box here, and you have, you know, these things here, and it looks horrible, but actually it's not. Everything actually turns out to be second order equations of motion.
So these cancels out. The fourth order cancel, whatever, cancels out. You just get second order.
Yeah, you just get a second order equations of motion. We have written the equations of motion down in our paper, but they are quite nasty, so I didn't copy them here, but maybe I should have. But yeah, indeed, they are second order equations of motion. All right, so now you look at the solutions of this theory, right? So now you have fully four-dimensional theory you can play with. In addition, you have a scalar field, but so what? Now you find solutions, and so that's what these two gentlemen did. And so they constructed spherical symmetric solutions. Again, you have, in general, two metric functions, f and something else here. But then if you look at the special class where actually these metric functions are the same when h is equal to 1, what you find is this beautiful solution, which is precisely what you get if you take d goes to 4 limit of the d-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet solution. So this is the metric you have already seen by doing this d goes to 4 limit. Of course, now in this case, this space-time, well, the geometry is also supported by the scalar field. So this is the corresponding scalar field. So now what is very interesting and puzzling to us is that you get the same metric here, no matter what the internal curvature, what the curvature of the internal space is. So whatever a lambda I choose here, I still get the same metric here, except the scalar field changes. So the scalar field knows about lambda, but the geometry does not. So anyway, so this is the solution. This solution has been known, the metric has been known for some time. So there is a paper by Tomozawa who claims, well, I had the solution in 1970s or something like that. Then the solution was also discussed here, but they were all considering this as quantum gravity, solution to some quantum gravity theory. But now we know it's actually a solution of this dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity. Now, what is also an advantage against, Lin's approach is that now you have a theory, so we can actually construct thermodynamics of these solutions. So you can use them in particular Wolff's formalism to calculate the entropy, and you see that the entropy actually picks up the logarithmic corrections. And so this is quite interesting space-time to play with. So no longer has A equal to 4 entropy, but it has logarithmic corrections, and it is a classical solution of a classical field theory. So now, what also many papers, in those 70 citations concentrated on is, studying observational features of this metric. So if actually you believe in this four-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity, there will be modified light bending, and there will be modified black hole shadow, and there will be some effects for accretion disk and stuff like that. So actually, I don't give references here, but I think that's very useful. What people have done is that they studied, consequences of astrophysics.
I have a question. When you take into account that the merging of the neutron stars with electromagnetic counterpart, that gravity moves at the speed of light, how does gravity, what speed does gravity move here? Because you have the scalar field coupling.
I don't know if this means,
it must constrain could be scalar field.
I'm sure it does. I don't know if this has been studied. It's a good question.
I think from what I looked at, the constraint is quite severe because the speed of light is known to 1 power in 10 to the 15 from the neutron star merger. So it really restricts the scalar field.
If it does, it's good. Yeah, I'll be happy.
Yeah, but you end up with not much.
Okay. No. If that is the case, then it's great. Yeah. Then we can discard this and it's fine.
Can I make a couple of comments?
Yes.
Just because you said, well, now we have a theory that has solved second order equations. And now we do have a theory. So let me push back on that. So having second order equations is not sufficient for you being able, for anyone being able to study physics in this theory. I mean, this is a paper by Pretorius and Ripley, where it show in a theory very much like this, which are going to generate things like shock. But even before that, your initial value problem is going to break down. So I'm just saying we should keep that in mind, that these problems are there. They're waiting for us. And whatever solution one ends up writing and then trying to do any chemistry or whatever with it, should be with a caveat that we don't even know where it is the case that the physics should be able to form those solutions. So for all the intern purposes, we may be studying something that's completely unrealizable within these theories.
Thank you so much for that. Yes, I agree completely. But of course, if you look at this, so you have these horrible terms here, but apart from that, it's precisely what people have been studying for a long time, right? So this is just here.
But those are the horrible terms that turn around and break your hyperbolic problem. And not only that, it changes hyperbolic into elliptic, going through parabolic in a way that there is no mathematical theory that, in fact, the only mathematical theorem that is out there telling you how you're going to be able to solve this problem, from a physical point of view, is completely nonsensical, right? You have to give data in the future in the elliptic region and then only partial data in the past. And that's the only way you're going to get a solution. So I don't know what any solution that people present me in this theory actually means from that point of view.
That's not a fair point. Okay. We also looked at the taut-nut solutions, which we thought, let's look at beyond spherical symmetric solutions.
David?
Yes?
I have a question. Sorry for interrupting. So when you did the conformal trick and subtracted g tilde, so is this phi the scalar independent of the metric, or is it just the logarithm of the determinant? So it's just, I mean.
Oh, that's also a very good question. I treat it as independent. I just treat the resulting theory as scalar tensor theory. I would say it has, 2+1 degrees of freedom.
If it is independent, then you're essentially adding a new field to the system. And then when you show that the solutions match Glavan-Lind solutions in certain cases, I mean, solutions coinciding, does that mean the theory is coinciding? I mean, we can argue about whether Glavan-Lind's original proposal is well-defined or not, but just the mere evidence that some class of solutions coincide, how can we get from there to the statement that the theory is?
That's also my question. Actually, I'm kind of confused here because as you claim that this counter term is just a topological term, But however, I'm not sure when this counter turn over a factor of d minus 4 and then take d to 4 limit is still a topological term. I'm not sure.
For me, this is especially apparent if you treat phi separately from the metric, because if you treat it as part of the metric, then okay, we can say with this, what is in the metric, there are just a limited number of things we can get. But if it's just now a new degree of freedom, it becomes more questionable.
But of course, you know, what makes the phi to be a real field is only the limit, right? Because if I start with this rescale metric, the conformally rescale metric, it's still the same theory, right? At this point, it's still the same theory, right? It's only after the limit when the scalar field becomes independent. Okay? So, and that's clear also in this Clausius-Klein thing, right? So in the Clausius-Klein approach, you just start with this ansatz here, so it's obvious that, you know, I'm just doing Gauss-Bonnet gravity in high dimensions, and then I'm adding the breathing mode to my internal dimension, right? But I don't know. In the end, it's independent field, but, you know, during the process of deriving this, it is not. I mean,
that term alone is the same theory, but so is the second term with a rescaling of the metric. But
it's really the d goes to 4 limit, which makes it a new theory.
I think it's just that, I mean, there's also not too important to mention that we are now treating the metric with two different scalings in the same theory. Then one alone is maybe the same Gauss-Bonnet, but if we combine both of them together. Even if without the D goes to 4 limit, it's just if we have curvature tensors built out of two different metrics, then this is more than just the theory we would get from those curvature tensors.
But you know, you should just view this term as a counter term, right? So this is just a counter term which does not change the theory. Right, it's just a convenient way how to subtract a divergence. You should just view it that way.
Okay.
Well, how much time do I have?
I should say, by the way, that the theory you get is a more complicated Brandt-Stickey theory.
Sure.
It's more complicated. And Brandt-Stickey theory has problems fitting the solar system. The coupling on Brandt-Stickey coupling has to be 8,000 or more.
But you know, so if you just don't consider these terms here and you just look at this, this is just the EDGB action or something like that. And I think it's well known that actually it's not so, you know, not so constrained as Brandt-Stickey. I think it's a little bit more freedom there. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not an expert on that, but I think you just had these terms. I think it's fine. And people, you know, people love this theory. If you don't have these terms here, people love this theory for some reason.
Why did they love it?
Well, people write, serious people write papers, right? That means people love the theory.
Why they love it is because it's the easiest thing to do. That's why they love it, because it's easy to take Gauss-Bonnet and put a scalar in front of it. That's what Lee asked near the beginning of the talk. But this is the theory you're going to get if you follow this procedure, and either it lives or dies phenomenologically, notwithstanding the other objections. It's not obviously a priori, quote, wrong. As Eric said, once you get it, you can forget about where you got it and then work with it.
Okay, so I think it's time to make I had a follow-up suggestion. And the follow-up suggestion is to take the scalar field and don't let it be arbitrary. Let it be 3/λ and let lambda be a field now. And then you get new symmetries, new dualities, and a very interesting, very different theory.
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
So the suggestion is, we played it out in a different way, but it would be fascinating to see how it works with this conformal trick. Set up the way you set it up, and then take the phi, the conformal rescaling, and set it equal to 3/λ, and let lambda be a free field, but restrict it to be three over the scalar field.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a duality symmetry. So De Sitter space and De Sitter space-like solutions, depending on the sign of lambda or anti-De Sitter-like, are fixed points of a new duality. And it's a very interesting, different class of theories that you then construct.
That certainly is interesting. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Maybe we should talk about that more.
I'd be glad to.
Excellent. Well, how much time do I have?
Yeah, you still have a few minutes, but maybe we should let David continue on.
So then I'll skip the top knot, but the message take home is that there is no Lorentzian top knot in the simple class of solutions. So again, that contradicts, you know, the standard naivety goes to four limit here. Well, let me just say a few words on lower dimensional theory. And so if you have the theory which we derived, well, we derived for, you know, in view of Eric's point of view, we can also, you know, extend it to lower dimensions, and there is no contradiction whatsoever to consider this theory in three dimensions or two dimensions. So actually, you have also, you know, three-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity. Of course, in three dimensions, you know, the Gauss-Bonnet term is zero, so this term is not here. But otherwise, everything works nice, and so you can also consider this theory in three dimensions. And you know, this can be derived by this Kaluza-Klein procedure with zero-dimensional internal space, or, you know, equivalently with this conformal trick, but now in three dimensions. And, you know, in three dimensions, there is really no problem with this counter term, because the counter term actually is not needed there. It's automatically zero, because this term is actually not here. So in three dimensions, the conformal trick works even more beautiful. So now we have three-dimensional theory. You can study the black holes. And so what is interesting is that you have seen, you know, this quite nice class of black holes, which look like BTZ, but they are not. Again, they are supported by some scalar field, which is logarithmically divergent. But this is the metric. It approaches the BTZ spacetime. It is a black hole for the well-chosen branch here. And of course, this has modified lambda. So effective cosmological constant is modified. Again, it has singularity in the origin, but it has the repulsive potential. So maybe, you know, the singularity is not that harmful. What is super interesting is that although this, you know, this solution looks very, very different from the BTZ black hole, it has exactly the same thermodynamics, which actually puzzles us a little bit. But that's what you get if you use the Wald formalism, and you get just the same entropy, and the mass is the same as the BTZ black hole, and so on. So you have this nice solution, which is a solution of the scalar tensor theory, which actually looks like a BTZ thing. Let me just lastly comment is that, you know, this thing actually is a special case of what you get if you take the naive D goes to three limit of the DD-dimensional Gauss-Bonnet theory. But in that case, you get also the kappa here, which is basically like the curvature of the black hole. So you can, well, it corresponds to the horizon. So you have either kappa zero, which, you know, kappa plus minus one, for spherical or hyperbolic black holes. So now, interestingly, so this was taken in this paper here, but what we find that if you take our theory, it's only the kappa equal to zero solution, which actually is a solution of the theory. So kappa plus minus one, actually you cannot get it in our theory. It's just a limit. Okay. So also another alternative theory, Bonnet gravity, which you get by this Kaluza-Klein compactification. But what is different now is that you consider D equal to four limit, but you have one dimensional internal space, and this is the theory which you get. So this is another theory. So in some sense, in four dimensions, you have only one Gauss-Bonnet gravity, which you know, conformal trick gives you the same thing as the Kaluza-Klein compactification. But in three dimensions, you have two ways how to do this. You either do D equal to four limit on one dimensional internal space, or D goes to three limit on zero dimensional internal space, and you get different theories. So we have two different Gauss-Bonnet gravities in three dimensions. And there are some interesting solutions to this, black hole solutions to this theory as well. So because of, you know, time constraints, let me just summarize, and then let me answer more questions. So in past 2 months, you know, papers on 4D Gauss-Bonnet gravity plagued our beautiful archive. So certainly the original proposal by Glavan and Lin of taking the naive D goes to four limit of solutions or equations of motion does not work. And so there's always some equations of motion which are purely higher dimensional, and you cannot get rid of these equations of motion unless you are in enhanced symmetry special case. So the theory is not four dimensional, actually. However, you can make sense of this limit in two alternative scenarios. One of them is the Kaka compactification, and the other one is the conformal trick. In either way, both lead to the same resulting theory, which is this scale tensor theory of Hodnesky type. And, you know, as Louis said, there's these ugly terms, but it's precisely these ugly terms, because of these ugly terms, you actually have some nice properties, which Louis would, I guess, disagree. But anyway, this theory is applicable in four, but also in three and two dimensions. What is nice about this theory? I would say it's nice that it's actually derived from a more fundamental theory, let's say high dimensional one. So you start with high dimensional Gauss-Bonnet theory, you compactify down. So that's typically a good sign. So that's what gives you this extra term here. Also, these extra terms actually guarantee that you have some nice, interesting analytic solutions. So I am not an expert on EDGB, but my understanding was that you actually have to construct the solutions, even spherically symmetric ones, numerically. Please correct me if I'm wrong. So here, you don't have to do any numerics. You have nice analytic solutions, which just give you black holes with this metric functions here. And so these black holes are quite nice from theoretical point of view because, you know, they have logarithmic corrections to entropy. There was this argument, which I'm not really by, but they, although they are singular, they're actually non-singular, and they have some, you know, interesting observational predictions. So let me just conclude with the question, is there Gauss-Bonnet gravity in the sky? I don't know. Okay. So please, questions.
Yeah, so thank you very much, David. So we have time for some... We have time for a couple more questions. Pablo, I see you raised your hand.
Yes, hi, Will, thank you. Hi, David, thanks for your talk.
Hi.
So I was wondering, I got a bit confused and kind of like following the ideas of Egit and also of Eric Poisson. So we start with this Gauss-Bonnet gravity with the D equals 4 limit kind of thing. And there you say, you know, this is no good. We need to fix this, but then you kind of introduce, you know, new degree, scalar degree of freedom, and you end up with like some sort of Horndensky or EDGB modified or extended theory. And then, you know, kind of like what Eric was saying, is like, okay, let's forget how we got there. Let's just use this as our theory. And then you start computing stuff and you showed us, you know, a few results, you know. So I was kind of like, confused in respect with your perspective, whether those results that you derived in this like Horndensky or extended EDGB theory can go back, or you can backtrace them to that kind of like the original question, is this 4D Gauss-Bonnet gravity, you know, really telling me something? And then same thing with Yigit's comment, you know, how can you, you know, the degrees of freedom from one and the other are a bit different. So how can you reconcile those things? Or is it just like, okay, 4D Gauss-Bonnet gravity doesn't work, turn the page, and I propose this Horndensky theory. Let's see what it gives.
I would say that that's more or less what I would say. So, I mean, it precisely corresponds to what Kurt is saying, right? So Kurt actually found that there's no other scattering amplitudes in four dimensions than those of GR if you just want tensor theory of gravity, right? What he showed is that if you reduce those of Gauss-Bonnet to four dimensions starting from higher dimensions, you get scalar tensor theory, right? So this actually tells me that, you know, what we are doing here is actually most right. So there's no way how we can go. So I would say there is no way how we can define pure tensor Gauss-Bonnet theory in four dimensions. Simply, it doesn't work. You get more equations. The theory is not well defined. It's actually higher dimensional, and so on. So there is nothing like tensor theory, Gauss-Bonnet tensor theory in four dimensions. The best one can do, I would say, is that you relax on just having a tensor and you just add a scalar, and this is what you get. And you know, this is the theory you have to deal with. And I would say that this is, in some sense, it's like what people have been studying for a long time because it was simple choice and because they could prove some nice properties about the theory. But you know, this is something which comes from, you know, a compactification or from some trick. And I would say that we should sort of take it seriously. And you know, if it's not mathematically well defined, so be it. Let's prove that it's not.
Right.
But yeah, I would just call this, you know, Gauss-Bonnet theory in four dimensions.
But then
you have to knowing that there is no true Gauss-Bonnet theory in four dimensions.
right, but
that is a good question.
You do have to.
Sorry, I think someone else had their hand raised. Pablo, were you done or?
Yeah, just saying that, then you do have to live with what Luis's comment about that extra term and what Pretorius and Ripley showed, right? That's all. Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I think, Kazo, you had a question?
David, wanted to make sure I understood this approach correctly. So it's not that you like really take this theory and drive the equation in them. It's like you have solutions in other dimensions, for example, the one that they propose, like in any discrete dimension. But then you take the limit of the action and then you additionally assume the solution will also be consistently still, you know, the correspondence between the action and equation would persist when you go from like district dimension 6 all the way to 4. And then is that like also the
no? So you know, what I was saying is that you can easily get limits of some enhanced symmetry solutions, which are solutions of higher dimensional Gauss-Bonnet gravity. Right? Yeah, so these solutions are known, and if you rescale the coupling, you can take the limit to four dimensions and you get something.
But
you get some
metric. Equations are derived, for example, at 5 or 6. They're not derived at 4.5 or something. Is that right or not?
No. So, exactly. So you need to have, you know, d-dimensional solution where d is really, you know, something which is, you just write d-dimensional solution, and then you treat d as a continuous parameter, and you take the limit d goes to 4.
So then there is no guarantee.
Right? And you get some.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm saying that
if there is no guarantee.
Correspondence between equation and action persists all the way through this continuous. Is that?
Of course. No. That's right. So that's why I'm offering an alternative. I am saying, well, let's consider instead of that, let's not do that at all. Let's just consider this theory and try to find solutions of this theory. And this is a purely four-dimensional theory with scalar field and tensor field.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so last question, because I think we have time constraints. Go ahead.
May I ask a question? I'm actually very confused about this scalar, because when you compute the perturbation by doing this scalar tensor vector condition, and then just look at the scalar sector of your metric perturbation, and since we still have diffeomorphism invariance, right? And then by performing diffeomorphism, we can remove all of scalar mode in Gij component. So the only scalar mode left over is on those lobs and shift. And then the scalar modes in lobs and shift, you can just simply integrate the thing out by solving the constraint equation. So at the end of the day, you have nothing left in the scalar sector. But somehow you have a scalar mode here. This is my first question. My second question is that still about this equivalence. Actually, more than 1 month ago, I did exactly the same calculation by using this conformal trick. And I got exactly the same result, but I didn't publish the result because I failed to convince myself that these two theories are actually equivalent. So I would like to suggest you to carefully look at this counter term. I don't think it's a total derivative. Yeah.
Well, certainly if you just do this in three dimensions, you don't need any counter terms. So really the problematic term is something like G times alpha. And in three dimensions, G is simply zero, so you don't need any counter terms there. If you do the conformal trick there, you don't need any counter terms, and everything goes down well. If you are in four dimensions, you have infinity times total derivative, And then it depends whether you are a mathematician or physicist. If you are a mathematician, you may be in trouble, right? But if you are a physicist, you just say, it's a total derivative, so who cares that it's times infinity, right? So, yeah.
And what about my first question? But if you look at the perturbation, apparently there's no way you can have a scalar mode.
Well, if you are not in four dimensions, no. But if you are in four dimensions, yes, you will. That's my answer. So maybe I should read, you know, more carefully the paper by Kurt, where he actually shows that, you know, if he, you need to have a scalar field.
Even in five dimensions, there's still no scalar mode. And
yeah, in five dimensions, there's no scalar mode. I agree.
Yeah,
in five dimensions, no. But in four dimensions, there will be.
That's very strange, because I mean, the simple argument of a diffeomorphism and invariance just simply wipe out all of scalar mode. I don't know, something must be
weird. Well, yeah, I'll be happy to talk more about this.
Yeah, something must be weird.
Okay, so unfortunately we have a hard time cutoff. But thank you very much again, David, for giving that nice talk.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks everybody for joining the seminar. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Bye.
Yeah.
Thanks, David.